When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Looking for something to do after Halloween is over? Are you into the strange, bizarre, and unusual? On November 3rd, 4th, and 5th, the Strange Realities Conference is coming back to Nashville, Tennessee, and streaming online. Come join us for 3 days exploring mysteries, supernatural, the occult, weird history, and more, featuring lectures, presentations, and workshops by Tim Banal, Zach Hunt, Leslyn Vance, Bryn Collier, Tobias Whalen, Brent Rains, Joshua Kutchen, Kiki Dombrowski, Recluse, Nathan Isaac, Christopher Ernst, Aaron Goulias, David Metcalf, Timothy Renner, Mallory Sawinski, Soraya Azcap, and special guest Steve Berg as your Master of Ceremonies. Make sure to join us for the fun and informative weekend online and at SIR Nashville November 3rd and 4th and online only November 5th. Tickets are available at strangerealitiesconference.com.
Welcome, guys. Welcome back to Conspiranormal. We are counting down to the Strange Realities Conference 2023. And pretty soon we will be doing all the promo shows that we will be streaming live. But tonight we're going to be talking about a very interesting subject, and that is the subject of Lemuria. We're going to explore it thoroughly tonight, and we have with us Justin McHenry, who has a book coming out pretty soon called Lemuria, A True Story of a Fake Place, and I understand this is about to be published by Feral House here, coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, hopefully the fall, maybe a little later. There've been some production issues, but it'll be coming out soon. A couple months, I would say. Let's just put it at a couple months. And hey, fellas, thank you so much for having me, too.
Yeah. Thanks for coming on. Thanks for joining us. You emailed me about coming on the show, and I was really intrigued by the topic. And you were gracious enough to allow us to read the book as well, even though it's not published. And it is a great book about Lemuria and just Absolutely. About the history of the concept of Lemuria and what Lemuria is. And I do notice that nobody can see this on the audio, but I do notice there's a lemur right behind you, and we'll be talking about lemurs tonight a little bit, which
yeah.
I don't know if I ever thought on Conspiranormal I would talk about lemurs, but here we are.
So key, so, man.
I will ask you, Justin, to get started. You know, what I kind of ask everybody whenever they write a book, like, what interested you in this particular topic of Lemuria? What was it about this that said, hey, I want to explore this and write a book about it?
Well, I've always been like a love mysteries and love like the unknown things, like X-Files was part of my favorite TV show of all time, Unsolved Mysteries, that kind of stuff. And so just being in that realm, in this realm that we're all inhabiting here, I've kind of just run by bits and pieces of Lemuria, like hear a little bit from the Blavatsky, hear a little bit from maybe the Shaver Mysteries. And so it's just hearing those bits and pieces over time. I'm like thinking, what has been written on Lemuria? Like what's there? And so there hasn't been much written about it, actually, like taking a overview look at the whole history of Lemuria. So I thought it was a good opportunity to kind of tackle a project like that. And, you know, to really dig into some kind of mysterious topics that I love too.
Yeah, and this is really a history of the idea of Lemuria. A True Story of a Fake Place is the subtitle. It's something that everyone who's into any of these topics encounters over and over again, but it's kind of mysterious still, and it has this kind of amorphous nature to it. You find it in all kinds of different forms.
Yeah, and it goes all over the place too. That's what like once you, I went down that rabbit hole, I wasn't expecting to go, you know, to Madagascar, to, you know, the Indian Ocean, Pacific Ocean, to inside Mount Shasta, to inside the, you know, hollow earth, the, you know, Mars and the moon and, you know, intergalactic space brothers and, you know, gelatinous sacks and cyclops and you know it's you're running the entire gamut of like almost cryptozoology with all of the sightings at Mount Shasta, and it's just it went all over the place, and it was a fun just to dive into all of those different kind of topics, and you meet Rosicrucians and Theosophists and everybody in between. It's fun.
Yeah, for sure. It's a definite saga about how this idea like has rooted itself into now really like the New Age movement is where you kind of end the book.
Yeah.
And so I guess the best place to start obviously is the beginning. So let's start with where did the concept of a lost continent of Lemuria come from?
Well, like the craziest things that I ran across was like just how central Lemuria was to like 19th, like really major 19th century scientific discoveries that were going on. And so that's where it got its first start was back in 1864, there was this British ornithologist, a guy named Philip Lutley Schlater, who was doing a review of all the mammals that are on Madagascar. And he ended it by reviewing lemurs. And so lemurs are only native to Madagascar. You won't find a lemur anywhere else on the world. And so, but there are lemur-like, you know, primates on South America and in India and other places in Asia. And so in his paper in 1864 called The Mammals of Madagascar, Schlater proposed this land bridge that connected South America to Africa to Madagascar and up to India. And so at the very end of it, the very like last sentence of his paper, he said, I propose to call it Lemuria. And the name just kind of stuck. I think he was just really good at naming, and it was a really catchy name, and it kind of just stuck in the imagination, and it's kind of just stayed there too.
Mm-hmm. Through all these different permutations of it.
Yeah. I think that was it too. There was at the time there was like, that was the explanation du jour for, you know, geologists and zoologists to help explain these kind of animal migrations was to just create a land bridge connecting two places. But all those had like scientific names to them, like, you know, the African Madagascar bridge or something like that. But, you know, because it was called Lemuria, it kind of stuck in the imagination. Also, it was in a good spot too, because especially the Indian Ocean, and it would become a good spot for later on when like the theory of evolution like comes in and kind of adopts Lemuria as the place where, you know, the cradle of humanity was located.
Yeah, you find in the narrative of Lemuria this back and forth between like the scientific development and speculation, and then all these more esoteric or spiritual movements. Like they really use the science of the time to give this air of legitimacy, I guess. And you see that in the development of theosophy and stuff that you explore.
Yeah, and definitely. And I think it's also that it was, these were just theories too, and they weren't like set in stone. There was no scientific basis to them, really. There was just like, you know, there's a lemur here and something that looks like a lemur there. There must be a bridge connecting them. So because it was so nebulous and basically unscientific, it allowed that kind of mystical element to weasel its way in and turn it into what it did.
What are the first glimpses of that transformation from these scientific theories into this more mystical narrative? Where does that really start?
It starts with Blavatsky. Like when she gets a hold of it and her secret doctrine and starts talking about Lemuria as the home base of the third root race of her, you know, her theory of basically of evolution, her own kind of spiritual evolutionary theory that she goes into. And what's interesting about that is she really like co-opts this German Darwinist guy by the name of Ernst Haeckel. He wrote this really influential book called The History of Creation, which came out in 1868. I think the first English edition came out in 1876. But it was just hugely popular popular scientific work that would be the first, he was a really good artist. Haeckel was a really good artist, and he drew this amazing map showing Lemuria right there smack dab in the Indian Ocean. And it was where he placed the kind of the missing link of evolutionary theory. So the history of creation really gets into how, humanity evolved, how man evolved. And so for him, Lemuria was the perfect place, a paradise that could house this, evolutionary period for humanity where, proto-humans turned into humans and then they, migrated off into, Africa and into Asia and Europe and all points. And so it was really through that that Blavatsky got her ideas and then was just playing off of that. She was doing some jazz there, man. She was really playing off of his ideas and really taking him to task throughout her, the second volume of The Secret Doctrine. Well, I would say that the most interesting thing about Blavatsky, though, and Lemuria was, she footnotes her book all throughout. So there's, extensive footnotes throughout The Secret Doctrine. And in every one, she says repeatedly, she's only using the name Lemuria because that's what, Schlater used, and that's what Alfred Russel Wallace used, and that's what Ernst Haeckel was using. So she was just using the terminology that other scientists were using. So it doesn't necessarily have to be, Lemuria. It could really be anything else.
Before we talk about these mystical concepts that she comes up with, mm-hmm. Blavatsky, because it seems like this is really rooted in Blavatsky and what she comes up with theosophy.
Yeah.
How does this concept, this scientific concept of Lemuria, how does it fall by the wayside eventually?
Well, okay, so it's a funny thing because Haeckel would remove all traces of Lemuria from his History of Creation book after The Secret Doctrine comes out. So he would kind of erase Lemuria from his map just because he didn't want that connection with Blavatsky. But it really... you don't lose the scientific aspect until the early 1900s when you have a guy by the name of Alfred Wegener who created the idea of continental drift theory. And so he looked at a map of the world, the Earth, and saw that all the continents kind of sort of, fit together into one big supercontinent. And so he theorized that the continents had drifted at one point and they kind of moved about. And so a part of that movement was Madagascar and India separating from Africa and kind of a slow-mo collision into Asia. And that's what created the Himalayas and everything else. And part of that collision is Madagascar peeling off and then kind of floating back down to where it was is located now. And he called that movement the Lemurian compression because he was, moving whole continents around, whole freaking continents around just to disprove Lemuria ever existed. So, and his ideas were kind of, not taken seriously for a number of years, not until the 1960s when plate tectonics started becoming were discovered basically. And so with that combination of plate tectonics and Wegener's idea of a continental drift, that's kind of our modern ideas of what the kind of shape of the Earth or looked like back in the prehistory days.
Because before that, the story of Lemuria really is coming from ideas of continents sinking and rising. And yeah. So there was thought that there could be an entire lost continent that simply just sunk.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was basically, they thought that the oceans just rise and fell. And that's what that was the, like, land masses were a constant. There was no movement of land masses. When the sea would rise and fall, and that's what, you know, basically took Atlantis out, and that's what would take other, these land bridges. That's what happened to them too.
So we should talk a little bit about Donnelly and how that's influential on
these
ideas. There's really about Lemuria without Atlantis.
Yeah, exactly. Right. And so, and that's what Blavatsky really tied the two together in the Secret Doctrine, because Lemuria led to the fourth root race, which was the Atlanteans. And you don't get the popularity of Atlanteans in the Secret Doctrine without Donnelly's, you know, work being published before hers. And Ignatius Donnelly, he was a representative, House of Representatives, through the Civil War for Minnesota. And he afterwards, he kind of just like a kind of failed politician after the war. And so he was a failed farmer as well. And so he was, but he was into science. And so he pulled together this work called Atlantis, the Antediluvian World, or the Antediluvian Kingdom. I forget which. But it was like the first real study into Atlantis that had ever been published before. And so it looked at all different aspects about the whole Atlantean myth, and how he thought the Azores were the real, you know, location of Atlantis. And so it was real, like, using the science of the day, like, you know, looking at taking reports from discovery missions, taking those reports back and using that, he theorized that Atlantis was real, and using also a lot of diffusionist ideas to come up with this, you know, idea that, you know, there was an Atlantis and it was out where the Azores are now. And it became a huge hit. It was like a bestseller of the day. And it was still publishing, you know, 60, 70 years after the fact. And so it's like this huge, huge hit that's really brought Atlantis back to the public consciousness like it hasn't had since probably, you know, Plato's time, really.
Oh, yeah. I mean, pretty much our modern myth of Atlantis comes from Donnelly.
Yeah. Every like basically everything. And he even set the standard for what we honestly have today with, you know, Graham Hancock and Eric Von.
Yeah. You talk about his whole style of like employing all these different fields, geology, biology, comparative mythology, and like this historical speculation. It's the template for like these earth mysteries bros of
today. Yeah, exactly. Yep. It's all there too. And it's, and they all should, you know, bow at his feet for what he did and setting the template for them.
You talked about the diffusionist idea, and that's really where Lemuria is becoming popularized, when this idea is really popular and widespread, and people are looking for this, you know, common cradle of mankind and civilization, and the same things happening and spirituality with people looking for this like perennial philosophy and all these kind of things. So that's really the milieu that Lemuria is existing in. People are looking at it as a homeland of civilization and knowledge for all of humanity.
Yeah, exactly. So it was a Haeckel, it was the cradle of humanity. It's where we became humans and then migrated off of. And then Blavatsky would take that idea and turn it into the cradle of, you know, spirituality for humans.
The idea of the root races that Blavatsky proposes. Because this you mentioned this with, like, I think the fourth one was the Atlanteans.
Yeah.
And this whole idea of basically that there's a de-evolution of consciousness, and that this is where really this kind of mythology of Lemuria begins to like take shape, and how Lemuria is really like Atlantis is also, but I feel like Lemuria is really embraced by what is now what we would call the New Age. Like, it's really more embraced by that.
Yeah. I think just because of the spiritual nature. And then also it's, you know, it doesn't have that like solid foundation in, you know, Plato's discourses too. Like it's kind of left itself to be malleable and to turn it into whatever you want it to be. And so, and like really Blavatsky started that whole trend because, her root races is her basically evolutionary theory on, you know, human consciousness and human spirituality and humanity itself, starting with pure spirit beings being the you know, the first root race, and then slightly less pure spirit beings, and then in the third root race is where, you know, those spirits take physical form, and throughout the third root race they become more physical, and actually towards the end become more human too, because it's a whole huge process in that third race on Lemuria, where, you know, they start off as giants, then they become cyclops with telepathic powers, and then they start evolving, you know, two eyes, and so it's a whole scene, and then it goes to the Atlanteans, and then Atlanteans leads to our current root race, which we are living in right now. And then I believe the sixth root race will rise up shortly somewhere in America. And then followed by the seventh root race, which is, you know, pure enlightenment, I guess.
And of course we encounter a lot of racism.
Exactly. Yes. So yes.
Yeah. I've heard some theosophists try to kind of rehabilitate this stuff, but she was definitely a product of her time, and
she was mostly native people, like indigenous people. She was really down upon them and how they were the closest to Lemurians, like the late period Lemurians, because they haven't, you know, evolved as much as say, you know, Aryans have. So, and you know what, that's like, she shares that with Heichel had, you know, established that in his History of Creation. And so that's where, you know, basically he created a whole tree of racism, like scientific racism, basically putting himself at the top, like these Indo-Germanic people at the very tippy top, and the people at the bottom were the closest to the Lemurians, and the people at the bottom, of course, are people of color. So
yeah, the idea that the sixth root race is going to rise in America, just as an aside, and some of the other these groups, like especially, like we're going to talk about this, but the IM movement, did they ascribe to some of this, that this is what it was going to happen?
Yeah, I assume so. There was some like offshoots of theosophy that took like the Point Luma, their theosophy group was in San Diego. There was I think the Rosicrucians, like the Amorc people, I think that was a big influence for them, and why they set up shop in California too. So
Blavatsky dies, and there's this kind of war between these various splinter groups.
Yeah.
And you mention Annie Besant as one of the people that takes over one of these groups, and she has her own ideas about Lemuria.
I was gonna say that's a whole fascinating chapter too. That would be interesting again, like the power struggle within theosophy after Blavatsky's death. But yeah, so Annie Besant was a, you know, fascinating woman. Before she even went into, you know, theosophy, she was like a very kind of progressive 19th century almost feminist, like a proto-feminist, and like advocating for, you know, women's health rights and reproduction rights and things like that in England, and getting in trouble for it too. And so she was assigned to review the Secret Doctrine. And so she read the Secret Doctrine, and that's how she kind of got folded into the Blavatsky world. And so after her death, she teams up with a guy named Charles Leadbeater, and they produce a series of books together. And Leadbeater is really a creep. Like, he's like one of the worst people you can. He's a serial child molester, basically.
Which she defended.
She kept bringing him back and bringing him back and bringing him back. And it's funny because she has like she has good qualities. She was a whole. She was when she moved shop the theosophy back to India. Like she was very focused on like Indian home rule and like the Indian freedom movement and things like that as well. And so, but it's with this relationship with Leadbeater that kind of produces like a whole different side of Lemuria. And they wrote a book called Man, Whence, How, and Whither, published in 1913. And it goes into some like strange places. And even like more dense somehow than Blavatsky's writing too, which is kind of hard to do. But man, you try to read this thing and it is hard to fathom what's going on there.
Yeah, I'd say obscurantist is the way to describe that.
Oh yeah, definitely. So yeah, but in there she talks about these beings from the moon and Mars traveling down to Earth in basket works. And they were, you know, these beings were helping humanity along. And so the humans on Earth at the time were the Lemurians. And so these, well, basically ancient aliens, I guess, were teaching the Lemurians how to be civilized and civilization. And so she describes these Lemurians as these like a huge, ugly gorilla looking like creatures with egg shaped heads and everything else. And they were fighting, you know, dinosaurs and things like that.
How does California end up having this central importance? It's, of course, on the West Coast. But you have this relationship to Mount Shasta, and I guess the Amark is really central in kind of updating this Lemurian mythology.
Yeah, it's kind of fascinating. I'm not sure exactly like how that happened. I think it was a combination of a couple of different things. First, you have Frederick Spencer Oliver's A Dweller on Two Planets coming out in the early 1900s. And I think a second edition was released in the 1920s that was proved to be pretty influential. And so A Dweller on Two Planets is another one of these kind of it's a channeled work. Oliver was a teenager at the time, and he was working around Mount Shasta or Northern California, I believe. And this being started writing. It basically took control of him and started like automatic writing for him. And so over, you know, a period of time, they began conversing, and it became, he came to learn it was Philos, the Tibetan. And so he was channeling this, you know, entity. And so for a number of years, Philos was coming to him, and he got, he made basically Frederick write a book for him. And so he channeled a book called A Dweller on Two Planets. And it goes into, it's a fascinating book because it's like, if you think about it, it's a really cool story because it's like, you know, Atlantean love triangle with, you know, spaceships and submarines and, you know, airship submarines, basically. But it's like super boring as hell because it's it gets into this kind of esoteric Christianity on every other page. But then the main character, that Atlantean character that he follows, dies and gets reborn in contemporary times, like in the Civil War period. And then he has his own life, and he goes to Mount Shasta, and this mystical, he meets this mystical Chinese man who takes them inside of Mount Shasta and kind of takes them on this, you know, mystical tour to Venus, and you know, basically learning, you know, Christianity along the way. And so that's really where the idea of there being this kind of weird Mount Shasta comes from. And it's not picking up until the 1920s when you get, Amorc and Harvey Spencer Lewis, the man who created or who founded Amorc. He starts writing about these kind of crazy things happening around Mount Shasta.
So that's the beginning of the whole Mount Shasta mythos is kind of pulled out of this, I guess you could say, channel material, but exactly. Kind of a work of fiction at the same time.
Yeah. Yeah.
I've always kind of wondered why Mount Shasta just all of a sudden became associated with that. And I know that there's some Native American legends about Shasta, of it being some kind of a mystical place. Mm-hmm. But then how it just gets all this, there's this big milieu around Shasta. It's crazy.
Yeah. And that's the funny thing. Before, I was trying to research what people thought about Mount Shasta before Wisher Server's book came out, who is basically Harvey Spencer Lewis, before his book came out in the 1930s. And you get these, you read these travel logs and travel stories about Mount Shasta and people just walking all around it and just having a good old time. But, they're not seeing weird lights. They're not encountering weird, Lemurians or anything along those lines. They're just, having a good time in the woods and then, climbing up a mountain.
And the Forest Service tells everyone that they surveyed the entire thing and they're still.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And that's very early on too in the thing. So within the early 1930s, when, it really becomes a kind of a marvel of esotericism, you have the Forest Service coming out and saying, hey, there's nothing here. We fly over it every day. We map it. There's nothing there, man.
So now we've got channeling also of Lemurians entering the picture, and Blavatsky kind of made the template with that, with the ascended masters and Mahatmas, but they were writing letters. But this is now, now we are channeling ascended masters. Now we are channeling Lemurians.
Yeah, that's what really takes it into the kind of the New Age realm too, because channeling, for a lot of channelers, Lemuria becomes part of their channeled entity's backstory. So for, let's say, Jane Roberts and the Seth material, Seth doesn't come from Lemuria, but he comes from Lumania, which is, just a couple of, letters away from Lemuria, but it's the same idea and the same kind of concept coming from them. So I'm thinking Jay-Z Knight, who was a big channeler in the 80s and early 90s, who's still around too. She channeled, her entity that she channeled was Ramtha, and Ramtha was, his backstory was as a enslaved Lemurian who was enslaved by Atlanteans. And so he kind of got this Spartacus revolt against his Atlantean overlords and did that.
I love how there's this, especially when you get into the Cold War, all of a sudden there's this massive conflict that has taken place between Atlantis and Lemuria. So it's just like the United States and the Soviet Union, right? I mean, these two massive blocks of land that are going to potentially destroy each other. And this is what happens. And the other thing, I forgot where it was, but the massive amounts of lengths of time that these wars take place in are just ludicrous. There's it lasted for 70,000 years and all this kind of stuff. No real idea of just how actually long that is. That's just the statement. Oh, it lasted for 70,000 years. This war went on. This struggle between Atlantis and Lemuria. And so it's an interesting, it's just another way of pulling in what was the struggle of the Cold War was, and say, hey, we could destroy ourselves, just like Atlantis and Lemuria did.
Yep. And so I think that was Maurice Dorial, or who came up with that fighting between Lemurians and Atlanteans. And he had the Atlanteans winning and imprisoning the Lemurians inside of Mount Shasta. And so like every 7 years, Atlanteans will come and check to make sure that the Lemurians were staying in place there. So, and he's a fascinating guy too. He's basically responsible for like the modern reptilian myths too, and all of that kind of fun stuff.
Yeah. He's kind of the pre-David Icke.
Yeah.
We should mention though to back up just a little bit, because I think he's a little slightly earlier. James Churchward and this idea of the lost continent of Mu, which he comes up with there's a whole entire history. There's this, you know, like it's pretty much Donnelly's Atlantis, but he's saying, you know, this is all Mu that started this. And so how does he come into play here with all these beliefs?
Yeah, so like he seemed to want to create a more realistic, I guess, place, kind of take it away from the mysticism and make it more grounded in, I guess, reality or maybe even more reality of ancient history. And so, he was a fascinating character. He was a colonel in the British Army, stationed in, I think he served in India. And it was there in India where he kind of had he basically cribbed Blavatsky's backstory. And he was taught by, you know, secret ancient masters in northern India about this secret language on these secret tablets and all that kind of stuff. And then he kind of goes about and has this, you know, travels around trying to, you know, basically doing like ancient history tourism almost. And that's where he stumbled upon the Les Plongeons.
I've always wanted to know how to pronounce that.
So. Yeah, I have no idea. So I'm just trying my best there. But they're British too. So it can't be like too, I guess, French, francophone. Yeah,
maybe it's a little anglicized.
Yeah. So Augustus and Alice. So there's this like British couple that just got the urge to go become mystical archaeologist in the Yucatan Peninsula. And so they actually were doing these like real excavations and finding real artifacts and things like that. But from those artifacts that they were finding, they created this kind of like out there idea of there being this kingdom of Mu. And that's spelled like the cow, like what the cow says, M-O-O. So it's just huge backstory of princesses running away from, you know, the murderers of their husbands and fleeing across Atlantis from, you know, Mexico, across Atlantis to Egypt, which was an Atlantean province. So that whole backstory. And so he befriends them. He becomes then actually when Augustus dies, Alice, you know, bequeaths him Augustus's papers and everything like that. And so he has that in his like kind of back pocket. And then along comes William Niven, who was this British mineralist who was like just basically looking for minerals, like precious minerals in Mexico. And he started stumbling across these tablets and these artifacts too. And he started like coming up with his own ideas of what these artifacts were. Now those artifacts and tablets that he was coming across were most likely put there by the local people who were, you know, forging them and selling them to him. So it was a way for them to kind of like drum up some money, it seems like. But anyways, Niven was taking these seriously, and then Churchward took these seriously. And so it was through Niven's tablets that helped prove the Plongeon's idea of Mu. And so he kind of dropped the O-O and turned it into a U. And that's where you get Churchward's Mu.
And then so this word Mu comes into the vocabulary.
Yeah.
It actually becomes interchangeable with Lemuria.
Exactly, yeah. And that's to give Churchward credit for, he never, and throughout, I think, six books that he wrote on Mu, and they're all like the Lost Continent of Mu, the Children of Mu, Sacred Symbols of Mu, Cosmic Forces of Mu. There's a bunch of Mu books. Never once mentions Lemuria in them. So give him credit for that. He stuck to his guns and his theme.
To mention also the Shaver Mysteries, which is published by Ray Palmer in Amazing Stories, which is published as I Remember Lemuria.
Yep.
So what is this connection between the Shaver Mysteries, the Darrows, the evil robots and all that stuff, which really a lot of that mythology goes into the UFO and flying saucer mythos and alien abduction mythos later on. What is the connection there with Lemuria?
Well, for Shaver and his stories and his what was happening in his mind at the time, Lemuria was Earth. So tens of thousands of years ago, two races of basically extraterrestrials or giant beings came down and colonized Earth, and Earth at the time was called Lemuria. And so that's where you get I Remember Lemuria. It's him remembering these giant creatures walking the Earth, and they were responsible for kind of creating these bioengineered robots, and that's where we get Darrows from. And so the sun became too poisonous for these beings. They kind of drilled underground and created, the cave systems and stuff like that, and lived underground. But even that became too poisonous. And so they, went off Earth and left all of these bioengineered robots here. Some of those robots, evolved and became able to withstand the, the sun, and they became you and I. That's what we are right now. Others are stayed underground, and those are the Darrows that kind of stayed underground and were these kind of mischievous little evil dwarf things, lizardy like creatures that kind of responsible for everything from, stealing your car keys, your socks from the dryer to 9/11. So
especially all right. Shaver's personal problems.
Exactly. Yeah. And so you guys have been talking, you had an episode a little while back with Adam Go Rightly about his book, James. And I see a lot of similarities between him and Richard Shaver. There's a lot of targeted individual, but for Shaver, it's these Darrows chasing him around, causing him trouble, and for down it's other things causing.
There seem to be a lot of figures like that in the mid 20th century. I mean, Downard was one of them. Shaver definitely was one of them. I think Carl Allen, or Carlos Allende, as you would call him, some called him, who basically came up with the Philadelphia Experiment stuff really by himself. A lot of these guys were all this type of they had been in mental institutions and these type of things. And these people like Ray Palmer would just hop on this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they would, in these science fiction magazines, and they would print this stuff as nonfiction. And so it just stuck, and it just creates this whole mythology.
And it gets repeated and repeated and repeated. If it gets repeated enough, then we take it for fact. And that's how we are where we are today, really. I mean, it's just the.
We're going to get into that. But going back to the Mount Shasta stuff, and I really want to touch on I Ballard, the IM movement. I mean, they are straight out of theosophy. And Lemuria obviously focuses pretty heavily in there, but this whole idea about Saint Germain and where Saint Germain, how Saint Germain is involved and how he's a Lemurian, I guess. I don't even know.
That's one of the remarkable things is Guy Ballard just whole hog took Frederick Spencer Oliver's book, the second half of A Dweller on Two Planets, and just stole it for his own backstory. So Guy Ballard, his claim to fame was he was walking around Mount Shasta. He came upon Saint Germain. Saint Germain gave them this like milky drink. He drank it, and then he just went on like this, you know, magical mystery tour, right, all over the place, and basically taught him like. And Saint Germain is like just another ascended master in a line of ascended masters. And so that's all basically also in A Dweller on Two Planets, the whole same concept of meeting this like mystical person and them taking you on a kind of this educational mind, you know, bending trip. And even like the name I Am and how it's spelled is, you can find that throughout A Dweller on Two Planets as well, because they spell it in all capital letters, I, capital A, capital M. And so that's all throughout A Dweller on Two Planets as well. And so it became so bad that the Frederick Spencer Oliver's family sued the I Am activity movement for copyright infringement because they were stealing the backstory so much. But the judge said, since Oliver had channeled, is it a channeled material? He did not have, you know, rights to that. So I guess they should have gotten Philos to the follow the
right.
But that's really where the backstory of Saint Germain comes from. For Guy Ballard, I think, and like the brains of that operation was his wife, Edna, who was really the student of the occult. And so she worked in. Let's get in the backstory of Guy Ballard, because he's just a kind of a creep. So he was obsessed with two things, like gold mines and the occult. And so he was always coming up with these like gold mine schemes and trying to finagle people out of their money, like just basically schemes to get little old women out of their life savings. And one of those schemes backfired and it got him in trouble with the Chicago DA, which is where they're from. The Ballards are from Chicago. And so he had to skip town. And so it was during that time where he was on the lam from the Chicago DA that he went to California. And it's during that period where he supposedly met Saint Germain. And in the book he wrote, he says he was on government business. And so I guess the government business was him running from the law.
And away from the government.
Yeah. Right. But during that time, Edna was back in Chicago working at an occult bookstore, having like, you know, readings with people, just really getting into like the nitty gritty of the occult. And so I think she formulated a lot of the like kind of the ideas behind the esoteric ideas behind the I Am activity movement.
But he was the charismatic leader that they needed to make it happen.
Yeah, he didn't seem that crazy. He seemed really creepy. Like if you look at pictures of him, he's like this just really like he got crazy eyes. That's the best way to explain him.
Well, then William Dudley Pelley gets involved, too. And I mean, Pelley is a straight up fascist. I mean, shirts and all that.
And, mm-hmm. And so he gets in trouble with the law. And the I Am activity movement kind of changes their language to pull in his supporters. So they're like they're stealing his supporters while he's in jail or facing treason charges and stuff like that.
Yeah, and I think that it was a vice versa thing too. I think where they were pulling, from the IM, and it was kind of a cross pollinization between the two groups, the Silver Shirts and the IM movement, but they were very closely linked, and you bring up a good point talking about Saint Germain about how really nationalist the IM movement really was. And in the figure of Saint Germain, they saw Saint Germain as he basically, and this is something I'd never heard before until I read your book, that in their idea was that he basically negotiated American independence, that he was the one really fighting for American independence. And Saint Germain was instrumental for this. And there's some things that started making sense there, this focus on Saint Germain. And out of the IMM movement comes Elizabeth Clare Prophet's movement. And they had a lot of emphasis on him, Saint Germain. And then, of course, you mentioned the, I was glad that you mentioned General Flynn and his basically taking verbatim Elizabeth Clare's Prophet's prayer, which is straight out of the IM movement.
Yeah.
And how, so how Saint Germain is like that figure that is very much like the symbol of America.
Like a nationalist saint. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
So this, yeah, this French nobleman, this 300-year-old French nobleman is the American saint.
Right.
And that's the thing too, is the IM activity movement. It's like, I think people would, it would not seem so out of place today. Especially in like QAnon worlds and stuff like that. I think there would be a lot of crossover there. People seeing.
No. So, and that's the thing is like, I've had some people say, well, Flynn doesn't know what he's doing. He doesn't know what he's talking about. He must have just pulled that from somewhere. And I've said, well, maybe he's just being a pragmatist. But when you wrote that in the book, that that is very possible that the real religion that he probably has is really something that's based on theosophy and not real Christianity. So yeah, of course, yeah. Elizabeth Clare Prophet also said, well, you know, I'm a Christian too. So, you know, that the distinction is, you know, it's this thing that's based in this new age philosophy rather than like, you know, like some like Judeo-Christian ethics.
Mm-hmm. And that's the funny thing about IM. Like when they started to lose a little bit of steam and not getting as many converts as they wanted, they kind of just threw Jesus in there. And even said like, Jesus said Saint Germain's a good guy. He's a prophet too. So they were just kind of just making it up as they go along. So it was just like, it's funny. And then you would have these, they would be on stage. And so they would have, there'd be Edna and Guy all dressed to the nines. And then like this perfect, I guess like white supremacist version of Jesus and Saint Germain portraits, mm-hmm. like just hanging behind them. So it's kind of fascinating and yeah. terrifying too.
So through Mount Shasta and the interface with Hollow Earth theory that also happens, we find Lemuria going underground, but then also we mentioned Palmer already and the flying saucer mythos and aliens come into the picture too. So it's really just gobbling up everything.
Yeah. And so, yeah, I think right after the Shaver Mysteries, and actually it's Shaver Mysteries, like there's a direct tie between it going downhill and UFOs coming up because I think the last issue of Amazing Stories that published Shaver Mystery was in 1947. And, you know, I think
Kenneth Arnold and stuff.
Yeah. The Arnold signing. That's what I was going for. Was right then, right at the same time. And that's when, you know, Palmer went, you know, full tilt into the UFOs too. And so there's a direct correlation there with those. And then like, yeah, with the whole UFO things, like it starts getting played into these new groups that are coming out, like the Aetherius, like UFO based religion. They part of their backstory is that, you know, Lemurians were part of their backstories. And then you have a group like the Unarius Academy of the Sciences.
Good old Ruth Norman.
Yeah, Ruth Norman, a.k.a. Uriel, and them doing these kind of past life regression, channeling things, pulling back, going back as far and talking about the Lemurian space brothers coming down and things like that. But yeah, the Unarius was also pulling from pop culture and everything, too, like admittedly, too, like they saw space brothers and everything. So.
Which, by the way, if you're interested, the entire movie of The Arrival, the Unarian propaganda film is on YouTube now.
Oh,
in
nice.
Its entirety.
Oh, that's amazing.
And it is amazing.
Yeah, I bet so. they were the only, like, I was getting the rights for pictures to use in the book. And I reached out to them to, like, you know, there was a, like, the LA Times had published, they did an art exhibit at some LA based thing. And the LA Times had these pictures of the art. And there was just one that showed Uriel, Ruth Norman, and, like, all of the Ascended Masters. So you have Saint Germain there, and you have, you know, everybody else. And so there's just, like, this really lovely painting right there. And I reached out to the Hunarius to see if I could get, like, a picture of that or something like that. And it was just this, like, semantic back and forth about who the Lemurians were and everything else. And it was just like, okay, I would just go buy something off of Getty then. I think that's
it was a little bit too much to deal with, huh?
Yeah, exactly. I was like, I don't think you'll give me what I want. So let's just go.
I mean, it seems like all this stuff really just, like, bifurcates. And it's like you start with Theosophy and you move down into the 20th century and in the UFO era, and all of a sudden they're just replacing UFOs with the Atlanteans, or saying that that's, or the Lemurians and stuff. And I notice another trend in the book is that Lemuria is this fantastical place. So all these things come from Lemuria. But then all of a sudden by the 1950s, well, we know Lemuria probably didn't actually exist. So now it's Venus, it's Mars. And when you get to the contactee movement, and Adamski has connections with, I think, the IM movement as well, and with Mount Shasta, more Mount Palomar, I would say, but Mount Shasta.
Well, he was in that whole, like, alternative California, right, like, religious scene. So.
Right. And so, yeah, it's very interesting that how these ideas just continue, and some of these theosophical ideas even filter down to a group like the Unarians. Like, yep, they're basically saying the same thing that the Theosophists were saying 100 years before them. Mm-hmm.
I found myself looking at the motivations of people a lot more than I thought I would. And then looking at it that way, it becomes clear that over time, Lemuria just becomes a tool for people to get their story across or get their ideas across or whatever. And so that kind of realization came to me as I was researching all of this.
Like a common reference point, a popular mystery that everyone has already encountered, and you're like, hey, well, let me tell you about the my version of the truth about Lemuria.
Exactly. And there's nothing that can refute them too. So that, I think that's what makes it such a convenient tool, is like, you can say that, but then it's like, prove me wrong.
Yeah. Before we started recording, we were chatting a little bit about when you encounter it nowadays in New Age stuff, mostly through the internet, it's really divorced from its history and all these, especially any kind of like primary source and things like that. It's now just like a part of the folklore. Mm-hmm. Of all kinds of different New Age practitioners and believers. So now it's just like everywhere.
Yeah. It's like a seasoning that people have to like sprinkle on their beliefs just to give it that authentic flavor, I think. And so that's what I ran across with Amy Carlson and her Love Has Won cult, like influencer cult thing that she ran. Because she said her backstory was that she was a former Lemurian queen. So she had no idea what Lemuria was or anything like that. No, like, you know, ideas about it. She just knew that she needed to check that box. And that's what Lemuria, I think that's really what Lemuria has kind of like become now. It's just a kind of a mystical box to check for people.
Yeah, and you mentioned in the book, you talk about going to the Conscious Life Expo or the Metaphysical Expo? Or
yeah, like, yeah, that? I just went to a local one here, yeah.
I mean, did you see anything there that, you know, supported some of the things that you wrote about in the book and like these ideas and these trends?
Well, no, just because I was disappointed because nothing was labeled Lemurian there. So I think that was just
right.
Yeah, I was looking there specifically for a Lemurian crystal. And so that's one of the most, I guess, prevalent where you can find, you know, Lemuria mentioned these days is as a Lemurian crystal. And so I was like going there specifically to find one, to buy one, but they didn't have one, unfortunately.
Don't ask for any Lemurian crystal at a fish concert or something like that. That's what you're gonna end up
with. You get something else.
Mm-hmm.
So to kind of sum everything up, why do you think that these memes about Lemuria, these ideas, why do you think they persist? What is their real staying power?
I think I was taken aback by doing the research about how like this alternative narrative was created and how it can be created. And throughout the book, you see it just shifting and turning and being like Play-Doh almost, and being able to mold it and turn it into whatever you want. And so I think that's the true staying power of Lemuria, is like it it doesn't have a text like Plato's text on Atlantis, like Timaeus or Critias. There's no foundational like work out there to you know inform anybody what Lemuria is. Lemuria can be whatever you want it to be, and because of that, it has been made into whatever anybody wants it to be.
Yeah, total blank canvas.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a whole blank continent, man.
Crazy.
You put dinosaurs there and all kinds of things.
Yeah. Dinosaurs riding UFOs going into the inner earth to meet up with the Ascended Masters.
Exactly. All the Ascended Masters are there.
St. Germain's down there, just, you know, founding America and all kinds of interesting stuff is happening.
We covered it pretty extensively. I just wanted to say that me and Adam really thoroughly enjoyed this book, and we think that our listeners have definitely encountered these themes and may be curious about them. Also, you've got a talk coming up with
the talk about
Philosophical
that.
Research Society. You can plug that for everybody.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, they have kindly invited me to give a talk about Lemuria. I think we're going to focus a lot on the relationship between Heichel and Blavatsky. So if you want like a nerd out on, you know, 19th century evolutionary theories and stuff like that, then, you know, give it a shot. I think it is October 21st. You can go to the psr.org website and find more information on how to get tickets and all that kind of fun stuff.
Awesome.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Justin, where can people find the book and when it comes out, and also where can they find you?
So yeah, the book is available for pre-order anywhere you buy books. Amazon,
nice.
Bookshop.org, I think Barnes & Noble, all those kind of places. And you can find my work. I'm on Instagram mostly, I think. Justin Loves History. I have a newsletter, Our Belated Past. Bunch of fun historical stuff I like to write about there. I'm writing it. Next one is on a hoax that Ben Franklin couldn't quit. So I think that's fun.
Cool.
That's it. I just want to thank you guys. Thank you guys for everything for Conspiranormal. I've been a loyal listener for, you know, probably a decade now. And so thank you guys for all the hard work you guys put into this. So I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you for coming on. That's awesome, man. Especially when you have now written a book. So that's,
I know, right?
That's incredible.
Never know who's listening.
I'm curious, what are some of the mysteries that you've written about on your blog?
Well, I have written about I'll post this one later, but it was actually published in Fate, but it was 19th century ghost hunting, which was fun. Basically talking about all of the instances of people seeing ghosts in the 1800s and then just shooting at ghosts and all the funny stuff that happens there. Talk about a ghost dog sighting in Richmond in 1876. What else am I going to get into? You know what I really want to look into? Talk about a Farrell House connection is the octopus. the whole Danny Casolaro death. Just because he died not too far away from where I lived. I lived in Martinsburg. Right. He died in Martinsburg. And so I would love to. And there's one little nugget from that book that I would love to kind of research more into.
Cool.
Yeah, interesting. That's definitely an interesting case. We had Ken Thomas on to talk about that a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah.
Whenever, like, I think there was a reprint of his book that happened. Mm-hmm. So.
Yeah, and I emailed him after. So Casolaro was in Martinsburg to interview staff of Robert C. Byrd, who was a kind of famous senator from West Virginia. And I want to know why. Like, why would he want to interview them? So,
okay, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting stuff, yeah. Well, I appreciate your loyal listenership for the last 10 years. That's awesome, man. Sometimes I can't believe I've been doing this thing for 11 years. It's crazy.
Yeah, right?
I want to thank you for coming on, for being a part of this. So stay on the line for us, but we're gonna close the show out. Just a couple of announcement, guys. This should be out before it comes out. If you guys, we're going to do a promo on this hopefully tomorrow as we're recording this. But Marco Azevedo going to be giving a Strange Realities online presentation on part two of The Spark and the Vessel. That's coming up on Wednesday at 8 p.m., the 27th of September, so you guys look forward to that. That will probably be one of the last ones that we will do before the conference. We are thinking about, in October, doing a meetup with no presentations for everybody. It's kind of like a pre-Strange Realities conference party. And which brings me, of course, to the Strange Realities Conference. You guys, if you have not gotten your tickets to either online or in person, please do so as soon as possible. There is a streaming Facebook group up. That's exactly how we did it the last few years. We're going to do it the same way. But to get into that, there's a $30 charge for online only. And if anybody has any questions about that, the whole entire conference is online. I've seen a couple of people ask me about whether or not the whole thing is online, and it is. All of it is online. It's just on the November 3rd and 4th, it is at SIR as well. So that's a live event, but everything, the whole conference, is streamed online. So just to clear that up, and we're really looking forward to it, guys, and this may possibly be the last one that we do in this kind of format. So you guys want to come out and check this out. But November 3rd through the 5th, November 3rd, 4th in Nashville, and November 5th online, but the whole thing streaming online. Anything to add about that?
I just love to see everybody. If you can't make it in person, love to see you online in the chat. We usually get to interact with everyone while we're running the show. Just wanted to say, check out our Patreon, patreon.com/conspiranormal, where you can sign up for the Mystic Crew to be able to view these monthly presentations, including this one coming up from Marco, The Spark and the Vessel, part two. Part one, everyone thoroughly enjoyed and had some excellent artistic and design work by Marco. That's his profession, on his views of the UFO technological imaginal, I believe is what he called it. But that'll be really great. Check that out at patreon.com/conspiranormal.
I think that is it. Just remember, strangerealitiesconference.com. I want to thank Justin for being here with us tonight. And starting next week, we are going to be streaming these live as well. We are going to be doing our Strange Realities Conference promos. So you guys check those out on YouTube.
You all are going to be absolutely sick of it, I'm sure. But that's what you're going to hear until November.
Until you pull the trigger and buy tickets. All right. StrangeRealitiesConference.com. And we'll talk to you later on
Conspiranormal.
When you need me. mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.